This is a download from Triple J.
For more music, current affairs, comedy and culture, triplej.net.au.
And now...
Triple J.
Triple J.
Triple J.
Triple J Mornings with Zan.
Good morning, Dr. Carl.
Good morning, Dr. Zan.
And we've got lots of questions to get through this morning, in particularly because these next 2 weeks are going to be the last time you'll be on air with us for, I think, about 2 months. You're not going to be coming back till February 2012.
That's right. I'm heading for auroras and Antarctica.
Of course you are. I knew you were going to Antarctica.
Again.
Let's jump straight into it because of that. 1-300-055-36 is the number to call. If you've got an answer or a comment and you can't get through on the phone, you can text us 0439-75-7555 or tweet Dr. Carl direct if you're on Twitter. His Twitter handle is just Dr. Carl. That's DocTorKarl. Joe is on the line calling in from Dubbo. Hi, Joe.
G'day, Dr. Carl.
Dr. Joe, welcome.
G'day. Listen, Carl, first off, I'm a big fan, been listening to your show for years now, and I find it very informative.
Well, we all work together towards enlightenment.
Yeah. And it was mentioned last week, I'm a carpenter by trade. Building sites go on go slow. Well, that's what I do. We have a no noise policy between 11 and 12 o'clock. No soaring or loud power tools. So we can listen to the radio.
Good
work.
What
sort of carpentry can you do without making noise?
No,
I think they're down tools for you, Dr. Carl. I think that's the point.
Well, mate, I don't completely stop. I mean, we've got to keep the economy going somehow.
Yes, yeah, it's true.
Just quietly, yeah.
Well, hopefully okay. Everyone's listening closely to your question. What's your question this morning, Joe?
About cookwares. I'm about to move into a new house with my partner, and we're about to buy some cookwares, some saucepans, fry pans, that sort of thing. And just wondering, with the variety that's out there, stainless steel, Teflon, or this new cookware that's out there, which is crushed granite. Now, I was wondering your opinion on what would be the best. Now, I've actually heard, an American doctor that's got a TV show, he said something along the lines with granite, that granite actually emits radiation. And he said that no doctors really, they don't like granite bench tops in their home for that reason because it emits radiation and causes cancer.
Dr. Carl, what do you think? Are there any differences between the types of cookware and are any of them dangerous?
They can all be dangerous, but not very much. If you want to go for maximum energy efficiency, the induction ones are the best, where you have a magnetic field and it oscillates around and you've got the special induction cooktop thingy, and then that heats up and that nothing else heats up, and that's the most energy efficient. With regard to granite contains uranium, but in very small quantities. The uranium then decays into radon gas. The radon gas then floats through the air, and then you breathe it in, and then you breathe it out again. But if you breathe it in and then it decays again, which sometimes happens, you then have a radiation-emitting source directly up against the wet, squishy stuff inside your lungs without the protective barrier of your skin. And so some people are a bit reluctant about it. I don't think it's a huge risk. What's the other cooking stuff? Teflon. Well, as long as you don't overheat, it's okay. I like cast iron. And I think the Maasai people in Africa have very high iron levels because they do a lot of cooking in cast iron pots. If you cook entirely in copper, you can end up with a bit of Wilson's disease. I reckon they're all pretty safe. Stainless I love, but the trouble is it's not very good at spreading the heat, so you've got to have multiple layers. So I've been coming back just purely from the cooking point of view to the heavy, thick cast iron pot. What do you use, Zan?
Yeah, I use a bit of a combination. I have of the titanium cookware for saucepans and stuff like that, and cast iron ones are good as well. They're really heavy, but they are really good at distributing heat.
Yeah, but the only one I'd avoid is the enamelled one because they're so hard to clean and they scratch.
I think that the point you make about overheating is a good one, that if you cook at too high a heat for what the saucepan or the fry pan is meant to be, then it will warp it and sometimes it will peel the covering off it. Same goes with cleaning as well. If you're scraping away at something that shouldn't be scraped at, then it might, get some flecks off it that you don't necessarily want to ingest.
Yeah.
Hey, thanks so much for the call, Joe.
Okay, thanks a lot.
See you,
Dr. Joe.
Nicola's calling in from Jamoyne. Hi, Nicola.
Hey, guys.
Hi, what's your question?
This actually occurred to me last night, and I was going for a walk listening to your podcast.
My question is, if it's raining, one person's running and the other's walking, who will get more wet by the rain?
Ah, this research has actually been done, and it's in my 18th book. And if you run in the heavy rain, you'll stay about 40% drier. Your greatest benefit happens when you are running in heavy rain, that's windy, and when you lean forward, and you get less of a benefit, maybe 20% drier, in light rain with no wind, and when you stay nearly vertical. You could take an umbrella, but of course that gives you lousy aerodynamics. But the trouble with running is that you have the danger of slipping and breaking stuff. And we know this because of an experiment done by two meteorologists who did this experiment in their own time with their own money, and they were the same build, so they bought two identical sets of sweatshirts, pants and hats, and, this is a very good look, two large plastic bags to wear underneath those clothes so that any rain which ended up on their clothes would not go onto their underwear. And then they measured out a 100-metre track, and they knew, because they were meteorologists, when the rain was coming, and they were able to test all sorts of stuff, and they ran and they walked in heavy and light rain under many, many conditions. And that's how you get the 40% improvement in the heavy rain and a 20% improvement in the light rain. But, mate, you can slip and break a bone or something, you know, so it swings and roundabouts.
There you go. Thanks for the call, Nick.
Thanks, guys.
Nina's calling in from Mornington. Hi, Nina.
Hi, how are you going?
Great. What's your question?
I've got a question about dizziness.
Mm-hmm.
I recently went on the ferry to Tasmania with my family, and I was fine on the boat. It was very low waves, 1 to 1.5 metres, but after I got back, it took me the rest of the day to recover from feeling dizzy.
Mm-hmm.
I had no problems when I was on the boat.
Ah.
So you had sea legs.
Yeah, I felt fine.
Yeah, so what happened was that your body had compensated for being on the boat, and then it took about half a day or a day to decompensate back. And why it took longer for you than for your friends, family, I don't really know. We could say things like the stones in your ears, the little crystals, were just a little bit less perfectly circular, so it took longer for them to get back. I don't like my explanations. I think I really need an ENT, ear, nose and throat to help me.
When you go to a park and all the kids get on a spinny randy thing at the park and they go round and round really fast, and it doesn't take long for them to recover from the dizziness.
Maybe it's because the boat trip over from, I'm imagining you went from Melbourne to Tasmania, yeah? It's a good 8 to 10 hours, so that's a lot longer, you know, and your body is adjusting, as Dr. Carl said, to, you know, an unstable environment, a la sea legs. So it takes a little bit longer to get back onto, you know, steady ground. That could be it. We'll see if an ear, nose and throat specialist can give you a more scientific response, and see if we can hear from them this hour. Thanks so much for the call, Nina.
Great. Thank you.
Thank you.
Zanny with you. Dr. Carl joining us as always on a Thursday, and we are talking science. 1-300-055-536. If you've got a question, give us a call. Daniel in Wandon did. Hi, Daniel.
How you going?
Great. What's your question?
I was just wondering, when in countries like Libya and that, when they celebrate like the leader's death or whatever, and they shoot guns into the sky, what happens to all the bullets that come down? Because they constantly shoot them.
The bullets end up killing some people. In New Year's Eve in Sydney, in Belfield, in 2002, a 9-year-old girl was watching fireworks with her folks from the driveway, New Year, and at 5 minutes past midnight, a bullet fell out of the sky and lodged in her upper arm.
Oh, God.
If she was a few centimetres to one side, she would have been killed. In Kuwait, after the end of the First Gulf War, the Kuwaitis celebrated by firing bullets in the air, and 20 Kuwaitis died. In Los Angeles, between the years of 1985 and 1992, at the place called the King Drew Medical Center, over that 7-year period, 118 people were treated with falling bullet injuries, and 38 of them died. Now, what happens is that when a bullet goes out of a gun, and you're firing straight upwards, it can have a maximum speed of, say, 3,000 kilometres per hour, which is easy enough to damage you very badly. But, yeah, usually it's less than that. But it goes up, slows down, gravity is working on it, wind resistance is working on it, slows down, then it starts coming down again. On the way down, gravity is sucking, but the wind resistance is slowing it down. So it'll reach a maximum speed of somewhere between around 330 and 770 kilometres per hour, depending on the weight and the shape of the bullet, and if it's tumbling and all that sort of stuff. You know, 300 up kilometres per hour. The thing is that 200 kilometres an hour is enough to penetrate your skull.
Mm.
So the falling bullet easily has enough velocity to kill you if it lands on your skull.
Yeah, right. Okay.
Thanks for the call, Daniel.
Yeah, you think they'd stop.
Yeah, totally. Luke's calling in from Watsonia this morning. G'day, Luke.
G'day, how's
Hi, Dr. Luke.
Great, what's your question?
First time calling, long time listener.
Thank you.
I have hyperhidrosis, which is excessive sweating, and I've done some research into stopping it, and some reports say that food induces sweating, and I've tried cutting those out of my diet, but haven't had any results there. I was not sure if I had too many variables in my diet, and I was wondering if there's basically a medical diet that exists that is considered kind of neutral and wouldn't aggravate the body.
How bad is your hyperhidrosis? I've come across one person who had it so badly, hyper, too much, hide, water, osis, state of, who had hyperhidrosis so badly that they could not work with paper.
I have worked with papers and things like that, and it does get very difficult. They tear apart in your hands, basically.
Because you're sweating from your hands?
Yeah, I have sweating from my hands and feet and armpits.
See, and the trouble is that the sweat glands in your body have their volume turned up too high.
Yeah.
They can run between hardly anything at all, where it's a very cold time and you're trying to preserve all your liquid, and you don't need to evaporate any liquid to then cool you down, all the way up to the extreme of being in a sauna at just under the boiling point of water, in which case you're sweating like crazy. And unfortunately, the volume knob has been turned up in your sweat glands too high. And in 15, 20 years, hopefully genetics will give us a cure for it, but at the moment we've got nothing. Now, you've been through medical care for this?
I've been to a couple of specialists. I went off a couple of years ago, and then I found the internet actually had a lot of information. And there's some research that's gone into diets and all kinds of other things, but nothing that really tackles what the cure is. And if anybody out there does have a cure, I had seen some articles, or once a guinea pig, I'm happy to move safe and help them.
Well, one thing you could do on your own ground, because you're interested in this, Luke, is go to Google, but look up Google Scholar.
Yeah, I looked into Google Scholar.
Now Google Scholar is probably the best that we've got today.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, I just wish there was something better, but we haven't got it. If you can find, by searching around, a diet that helps in any way, and if it works for you, even though it's not medically proven, go with it, because at least you're not sweating so much.
Yeah, oh yeah.
I think that's the best you can do with this condition. People have done things like getting Botox treatments, which is very painful.
Yes.
It kills the sweat glands for a few months. And even though the pain was terrible, they did it.
Yeah, I've considered that. I've got a Twitter account. If anybody does have any research, do you mind if I...
Yeah, what's your Twitter name, Luke?
Alan_STR.
How do you spell Alan?
L-M, letters, as in Luke and then surname, M_STR. But, yeah.
So L for Lima, Mike, M for Mike, underscore.
Yeah, yeah. S for Steve, T for Tom, R for Roger.
All right, Luke. Mm-hmm. Well, good luck in your quest.
Best of luck.
Thanks
I
for
hope
the call.
Something works for you, Dr. Luke.
Thank you.
Let's get to Townsville, where Peter is on the line and he has a theory under his belt. Hi, Peter.
Hey, how you going, Dr. Zan?
Great. What's your theory?
Well, my theory is that your lower spine position has a direct result on how far you can drive before you start falling asleep.
Your lower spine position has a direct result on how far you can drive before you start falling asleep.
All right, I'll put my case forward.
Yes, please do.
When you're driving long distances and then you start to settle into your driving position and your morning coffee wears off and you start feeling your back is uncomfortable and then you start arching your lower spine forward to make your back more comfortable, you find that your consciousness, or you stop getting drowsy.
Mm-hmm.
And you find that your drowsiness just disappears and your eyes start to sparkle. And as well as providing more comfort, what I was figuring out, within 40 minutes I was starting to fall asleep. And it just depends on your back, and it depends on your body makeup. I'm a normal carpenter. I'm about 6'2". I've got a bit of a dodgy back, but sometimes I'd be just losing consciousness within an hour, you know, and I'd have to snap my head side to side to try and keep awake.
So you reckon posture helps you? There was an Australian guy from Tasmania who came up with some sort of posture method that does help in certain cases. And well, I'm sure it would help in some cases of people who've got back problems, that it would stop them from falling asleep. But in general, tiredness makes you go to sleep and having a sleep keeps you awake.
Well, I found that when I started to use a towel and then I bought something from my chiropractor, but I found when I arch really tightly my lower back forward and provide the lumbar support that my seat doesn't have, mm-hmm. I can drive for 3 hours without even looking like falling asleep. It doesn't matter how much coffee I did have or didn't have in the morning or what I've been doing the night before.
So you're saying having the arch going, having your back arched stops you from falling asleep and you've got a history of lower back problem.
I'm a pretty normal carpenter. I can do anything on the job, but if I overdo it, my back is a bit of a problem. But this correlates with different seats. When you're sitting down at a meeting, it's exactly the same thing. A tall back probably has different sort of requirements than a normal short person, I guess.
I'm thinking here, Zan, that what we need is somebody who's a specialist, not in the sports physiology, but in office furniture physiology, you know, like occupational health and safety.
Yeah.
Somebody who would know about this. If they could Twitter into us,
thrilled. Give us a text on 0439 757 555. We'll see if we can find out more for you, Peter. Thanks for your theory.
Thank you, Dr. Peter.
Good on you, mate. Speaking of the text line, we've had a couple of people text in about our last caller who was suffering from hyperhidrosis.
Mm-hmm.
AJ in Newcastle said, tell the guy to look up the Primal Blueprint, which incorporates both diet and exercise. I think the diet side could work for him. I've never felt better in general, and the mild hyperhidrosis that I had is gone. And Joel in Coffs Harbour said, there's no cure, but I use a roll-on deodorant with aluminium in it from the chemist. It stops it completely, but also hurts and takes a while to get used to it. So a couple of tips from people who seemingly also suffer from hyperhidrosis. Thank you for those people texting in. Let's head now to Adelaide, where Sophie's on the line. Hi, Sophie.
Hey, how are you going?
Great. What's your question?
I was just wondering, like, when you get a song stuck in your head that you can't get out of your head, why is it that sometimes you can only remember, say, the chorus? Like, you can't remember the entire song.
Oh, where's our Canadian dude, Dr. Zan?
Oh, yeah, Daniel Levitin, who knows all about the science of why songs get stuck in your head.
Yeah. It's so annoying.
We know the guy who doesn't know the answer.
Well, I actually can't remember either, which is hilarious because your question is about not remembering an entire song. We can say that the book that you should check out is by a guest that we had a little while ago, a really amazing music producer and also scientist by the name of Daniel Levitin. He wrote a best-selling book called This Is Your Brain on Music, and it will answer that question and a whole bunch more. He might have some help for you. Thanks so much, Sophie. Sorry we couldn't remember the answer for you this morning.
Okay, no,
we forgot. We both forgot.
Hey, speaking of not having to think about things, sometimes people help us, Dr. Carl. You have a couple of answers that have come through on Twitter.
And it was wonderful to get this paper from America about granite bench tops. And yes, there is no doubt that there is radiation coming out of granite bench tops. But this paper that somebody sent me from America, entitled Assessing Radiation to Radon and Radiation from Granite Countertops, dated April 30, 2009, says that yes, there is radiation, but the amount that there is 1/40th of your normal maximum background level that you're allowed from radon.
Okay.
So, yes, there is, but it's 1/40th. It's really, really small.
All right. And you had another question? Another answer as well?
No, that was the only one so far.
Okay, cool. 1300 055 536 if you've got questions for us today. Bob's calling in from Heathcote in Victoria. Hi, Bob.
Hey, mate. How are you?
Good. Thanks for staying on the line. You've got a question for us.
Yeah. Dr. Carl, you'll relate to this one. When you get hit in the nuts, why do you feel so sick?
It's probably an evolutionary thing, because you might think that your whole reason to be on Earth is to meet friends and have a good time and love people very much in a very special way. And yes, the main thing is to love people very much in a special way, to make babies for the next generation. The main reason that you are around is to you know, from an evolutionary point of view, is to get the next generation going. So the testicles have got a very neat little system where they're loosely attached to the body, they're made of spongy stuff, and they can absorb most collisions without permanent damage, but they, via pain nerves, send a signal to your brain saying, you don't want to do that too often. And by the way, here's a way of just reminding you not to do it, because your real reason is to make little babies. So I think that's the evolutionary reason. Mind you, you can have very nasty kicks that can cause permanent damage, but in general they will survive with a strong signal. The pain is out of proportion to the damage. So you get much more pain than you would in, say, relation to, a injury to your arm, your bone, your skin, etc.
Okay.
Just to warn you, this is an important area.
Thanks for the call, Bob.
Thank you.
See you, mate.
Thank
you. And protect that area as well. Claire's calling in from Launceston. Hi, Claire.
Hello. How are you?
Hello.
Great. You
Hi,
sound very excited to be talking to Dr. Carl.
I am. I'm so excited. I love Dr. Carl. He's so enthusiastic about life.
I love you too.
As you are. So hit us with a question and the enthusiasm will spread out across the country.
Okay. Well, my question is, I'm sure everyone will be able to relate to it. When you have a little bit too much to drink and then you're fine, but then all of a sudden you go to bed and the whole world spins, I want to know why it only spins when you go to bed and lie down and close your eyes.
Okay, now the thing is that you're going to bed voluntarily. It's not as though the room is about to spin anyway and you're about to fall unconscious.
No,
you're still okay.
It doesn't happen when you pass out, Dr. Carl. It's only when you're trying to make yourself go to sleep.
Right, so you're okay while you're standing up. And then you lie down. Okay. Now, alcohol is a wondrous substance. It can preserve body parts for centuries. It can strip stains off your garage floor. And in small doses, it seems to be good for humans. Not large doses, certainly not the doses that make you spin. And that's God's way of saying, don't drink so much alcohol because it'll make your head spin and you'll suffer for it. The alcohol is a great penetrant. It penetrates into your blood and into the little tiny crystals in your balance centers, and alcohol is less dense than water. It actually floats. So the normal position of these crystals is displaced. They want to float a little bit higher than they normally do. You've been standing up most of the time, or being at least vertical, you know, the back part of your body's vertical, so you're just sitting up and you're drinking alcohol, and gradually the alcohol level is rising, and gradually the crystals are changing their density, their buoyancy, how they float or how they are aligned with the rest of the balance system. But because it's happening gradually and you're all vertical, everything's fine. When you then tilt everything by 90 degrees and lie down horizontally, suddenly you've got this buoyancy effect, and then the crystals are floating and they're banging against hairs that they shouldn't normally be banging against if they were at normal density. But they're not at normal density because they're infused with alcohol. And sometimes you can find this weird thing where as you gradually get soberer the next morning, the room spins in the opposite direction. Now, this is an interesting game to play.
Wow.
So if the room is spinning, you're thinking, oh, it's spinning, but because I am a scientific drunk, it is spinning in a clockwise direction. And then when you wake up in the morning and then you try to stand up, think, ah, yes, the room is spinning, but it is in an anti-clockwise direction, or for our American listeners, counterclockwise.
So if you went to sleep sitting up in a chair, you would lessen the chances of the room spinning.
I think that would be an interesting, from theory, yes, but the experiment has not been done in the peer-reviewed literature.
I'll do that, and I'll let you know.
You're my kind of person, Claire.
However, we don't encourage getting that drunk, Dr. Carl.
We do, but on the other hand, we definitely do not encourage getting drunk.
No, but in the name of science.
Just be, you have to run it past the ethics committee?
Just be very careful, Claire. Be very careful. We're not responsible for this.
We're not responsible.
Take care of yourself, Claire. Thanks for the call.
We are responsible, but not for you.
Bye.
Bye, Dr. Claire. Thank you. Do the experiment.
We're incredibly responsible for ourselves. Adam's calling in from the Gong, Wollongong today. Hello, Adam.
Hi, guys.
Hi, Dr. Adam.
Hi, what's your
show?
Question?
I'm just wondering, what is the best chance/project of humans colonizing space or, you know, other planets as of now?
I think that the next way is that we have to invent the ladder to space. The thing that's killing us are the enormous costs of getting into space of the order of $20,000 per kilogram. Yes, the business side of getting into space is good because they didn't have to do all the basic research, which the governments have done. They can coast on the back of that. But even so, it's still going to be incredibly expensive. The ladder to space, the space elevator, would be the way to go. And we are just now getting the materials that are strong enough to support their own weight. So basically you have a ladder that's 36,000 kilometres long. And for several tens of dollars worth of electricity, over a couple of days, you travel at 36,000 kilometres.
Wow.
Good answer. Good response, I should say. Thanks for the call, Adam.
Thanks.
We're going to head to Darwin now, where Amy's on the line. How hot is it in Darwin today, Amy?
Pretty warm.
Pretty warm. What's your question for Dr. Carl?
I'm in Darwin and I sit in my nice and cool office and then I go out at lunch and hop in my cooking car. And for the first 2 minutes before the air conditioner can sort of kick in and get the car to work and it's really hot, I get crazy goosebumps and actual physical chills and shudders down my spine.
Why?
Going from like a cool to a hot environment, it's really odd. And I was just wondering why.
Ah, but it's not just going from cool to hot because it's extra hot in the car. The air is trapped, it's stagnant, and it's much hotter than the outside air, isn't it?
Yes, it is.
And you get goosebumps.
Yeah, full-on goosebumps and, like, sometimes chills and shudders for about, the first 1 or 2 minutes.
What if you wind down all the windows and then drive around with just the ambient air coming through? Does that improve things?
I'm not sure. I haven't actually tried that. I'm normally just trying to cool the car down as quickly as I can.
So the thing to do is to firstly turn on the aircon to full. We're not talking here about energy and the environment, but just an interesting experiment. Turn the aircon on to full, wind down all the windows so you blow the old air out by your forward motion.
Yep.
So instead of having super hot air, you've just got the ordinary outside hot air and then wind the windows up again. So then that's all you're trying to cool down. You see, the thing about goosebumps is that they are normally part of the famous 4F flight or fight response.
Yeah.
And so by having goosebumps, your body is perceiving this not just as something inconvenient, but as a threat to your life. And I don't know why your sympathetic nervous system, which is there for the 4 Fs, which are fight, flight, fright and making love, why your sympathetic nervous system has been kicked into action. I don't know why. But maybe for you, sweating is really bad.
Yeah, but I like the hot. I hate being cold.
Well, you're in the right city for it.
Yeah, but maybe too much is... Look, I don't know why this is happening, but at least you can try alleviating it by blowing out all of the super hot air by having your windows down. Can you let us know how you go with that little experiment?
I sure can.
Thanks for the call,
Thank
Amy.
Awesome. Thank you.
We've had a couple of other texters in relation to why your head spins when you lay down. Two people, in fact, texted and said putting a leg on the ground to earth yourself stops you from spinning, your head from spinning. Two people texted that in. So thank you for being part of the Science Hour and helping us out here at Triple J. Jake in Foster does. Hi, Jake.
Hi, Dr. Carlin. Zan, how are you both doing?
Dr. Jake, welcome.
Good.
My question is, over a period of, like a long period of time, do the positions of the constellations in the solar system move from where we see it? Because if we orbit the sun, and I know it's, like, I don't know how many years it takes to orbit the sun, but, yeah, I'm just wondering why from, you know, when Galileo was looking at the stars and writing down where their position and stuff, they always seem to, I know, you know, I've only been around for 35 years and been taking notice for maybe 25, but they seem to always be in the spot, and you would think they would gradually move.
They do shift, roughly, by one complete circuit every 23,000 years. Now, just think about the Earth going around the sun.
Yeah.
The orbit changes from circular to oval and circular to oval every 100,000 years. Okay, right. Forget about that one. And then the Earth is tilted slightly. Now, think about it. So the Earth's going around the sun once every year. It goes around the sun, spin. It spins on its own axis and it's going around the sun. And it's tilted at around 23.5 degrees at the moment.
Yeah.
Over 43,000 years... it oscillates from 21.5 to 25.5 and then back to 21.5. Okay, forget about that one. The next one is the one that counts. So the Earth's going around the sun. It's tipped on its side a little tiny bit by about 20-something degrees, but it gradually sweeps out as it's going around the sun over 23,000 years. That spinning top sweeps out one complete circle. So it's a bit hard to explain, but imagine that you got your finger pointing at an angle and then you slowly sweep that finger around to describe a cone and it takes 23,000 years to do that. And that then means that the constellations shift by a complete circle once every 23,000 years, which means every 2,000 years they switch 1/12 of it, or roughly, there's 12 constellations, roughly one constellation every 2,000 years. They do shift, but very slowly.
Well, having said that, and I'm someone who firmly believes in that we are contributing to global warming, but looking at it from a I try to look at it from both sides of the fence. And would it be fair to say that we could be in a cycle where the Earth coming closer to the Sun in the oval orbit, so gradually the Earth heating up because of that? Because it's undeniable that how much CO2 we put back into the and all the other stuff that we do. But just looking at it from a logic way, would that be a contribution to the slight shift in global warming that we're having?
No. Number one, the scientific debate is over and global warming is real because it's going to be bad. The fact that there is thought to be a debate is pushed by the people who want to keep themselves wealthy and keep doing business as usual. It's like tobacco smoking. By the 1950s, we knew that smoking tobacco caused cancer. But it took until 1979 before the New York Times said, no, there's no debate about it. It's just done. 2 + 2 = 4. There's no way you can debate that it equals 3.7. There's no way you can debate that smoking does not cause lung cancer. So the forces of disharmony are trying to promote that there's a debate. There is no debate. So secondly,
I was just looking. I try to do everything I can to reduce my carbon footprint, but at the same time, I was just asking that question because it's something I wondered about.
Okay, now the second thing, with regard to the effects of the variance in the amount of energy that the sun dumps on the Earth. And we have looked at those very carefully, and that was examined. It was thought to be a contributing factor, and it was well and truly disproven by about 2004.
Okay. Cool.
So, but people keep on saying, oh, but what about the fact of the sun varying in brightness? It's not a constant candle. Yeah, disproven in 2004. You know, it's just like the old tobacco smoking thing.
As a scientist, but would you look at it?
Hey, Jake. Sorry, mate. I'm going to have to move on to another caller.
Thanks, mate.
I feel like that conversation could have kept going, which would mean that we wouldn't be able to talk to Shiloh, who's on the line from Hobart. Hi, Shiloh.
Hi, Shiloh.
Oh, hello.
Hello. What's your question?
I was just wondering whether eating sugar suppresses your immune system.
Yes and no. If you eat so much sugar that you become obese, and you know, that's defined as 20% above the normal range, and people who are obese have 13 times more lost work days, and medical claims are 7 times more expensive. And so, yes, your immune system is involved in that. Having just a one-off hit of sugar, I don't think it does stuff to your immune system. However, it's more complicated than that. And so in babies, sugar can act as a painkiller. So you're going to do the right thing by the baby, and you're going to immunise the baby to protect it from diseases, and the baby's going to cry because there's this sharp needle going into it. If you give the baby a little swig of sugar beforehand, they don't feel so much pain. So sugar definitely has short-term effects. I have not been able to come across anything reliable in the peer-reviewed literature that says that sugar depresses your immune system. Are you talking about the fructose thing?
I've heard, very unreliable, of course, that if you eating sugar, straight away, your immune system might drop or something.
No, some people demonise sugar. I personally tend to avoid it. When I was an unhappy bachelor and only half the human being that I am today, I bought a kilogram of sugar, and as a single person, I had 80% of it after 10 years. The moment nowadays we've got a family and we're making cakes and stuff all the time. Mate, we're getting semi-trailers come with sugar to our house. Okay, I'm not quite, but I'm exaggerating.
Wow.
But I don't think it's that bad. But certainly remember the lesson of Jenny Brand Miller. Avoid that sugar spike. So your sugar goes up, your insulin goes up, and then you go down. Try to be moderate. Effects on immune system, hard to believe, but please Twitter me if you have an answer on it, somebody, please.
Thanks for the call, Shiloh. Yeah.
Thank you very much.
We're going to go to Narara in New South Wales. Justin's on the phone. Hi, Justin.
How are you?
Great. What's your question?
Why are they using perpetual motion machines to create energy?
Why are they not using them? The thing is that perpetual motion machines don't work.
Hello?
Can you hear us, Justin?
Okay, Neil.
Okay, yeah. Dr. Kyle just said perpetual motion machines don't work. Did you hear that?
No, I missed that, sorry.
Okay, well, there you go.
Perpetual motion machines don't work. What do you think that they work?
I believe there's a way to overcome the problem.
Let me tell you this. In all of human history, nobody's ever succeeded. You could succeed. You could succeed if you spend the rest of your life doing it. I think the chances of that are about equal to the chances of being kicked to death by a duck. and it would be a waste of life. It's not impossible. You see, the laws of thermodynamics are not fundamental laws derived from the structure of space-time, from our fundamental knowledge of physics. Rather, the laws of thermodynamics, which are the ones that say you can't build a time machine, you can't build a perpetual motion machine, they're based on observation. But the observations are such that nobody has ever built one that works. Nobody. Okay.
There you go. Answer, Justin. Thanks so much for the call. We've got time for one more very quick one because I want to get this one in because it's a poo question to finish
hello,
off.
Hello, poo question.
Hello, poo question, also known as Nathan from Port Elliot. What's your question, Nathan?
Hello. Just regarding feces, if a person eats the same quantity of food, yet one sits still and the other one is exercising, is the volume of feces going to change?
Good question. Dr. Carl, yes. A very short answer?
Very much so, yes. They will change.
Why?
But then it depends upon gastric motility and whether your exercise is such that you're making yourself healthier so that you're shoving more stuff through your gut, or whether you're actually doing so much exercise that your gut is being slowed down. It's a complicated question. I'd have to have more time. So, but definitely it will change.
You just won me a grand, mate. You're a legend.
A grand?
A grand?
You just won a grand for a poo question.
I know, it's strange but true.
Is it possible to burn off the food that you've just eaten, Dr. Carl, or does it still need to go through the system?
The dead bacterial bodies are always coming through your system.
Okay.
But it will change.
Because it's the waste, isn't it? It's the stuff that you don't need that leaves your system.
That is correct.
Or excess.
Excess. In the case of urine, that's not so much waste as necessary to throw out waste products. So not all of urine is waste, but most of feces is... I think that's right to say that. This is suddenly a very deep question, Doctor. And you got $1,000 for it.
Unbelievable. Nathan. We're in the wrong game, Dr. Carl.
Hey, no, we're in a game of giving enlightenment and helping people.
So
Justin
true.
Is very happy. Nathan is very happy.
Thanks so much for the call, Nathan.
Thanks, guys.
See you later.
Thank you.
Enjoy the $1,000 for the poo question. Unbelievable.
Jeez.
Hey, Dr. Carl, we've got one more week to spend with you and science, the love of it all, next week. Same time, same channel, of course. Shall we see you then?
Oh, I'll be so happy and yet so sad. Aurora's in Antarctica calling me, but I still want to be with you.
See you in a week.